Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Scott Lemieux from the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money will make it 2 weeks in a row as we discuss this week's latest Supreme Court rulings. Heather Digby Parton will help me break down the news of the week. And Eric Umansky from ProPublica will tell his personal story from last Halloween when a child was hit by a police cruiser and how the NYPD was shielded from accountability. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor. Support the program. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. Remember, during COVID, we're releasing the entire show for free, but we still need your support. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from the blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, of course, we have some big Supreme Court stuff to talk about, but we're going to be talking about Scott Lemieux a little bit later in the program about those things. And this week, there were some primaries and some primary results, ones that I wasn't terribly happy about. We also had a pretty good referendum. We will get to that as well. And we should also talk about what is going on in this country. It's in terms of the coronavirus just now is exploding, well, once again, but this time in different states around the country, with some difference in the way that it is manifesting itself amongst the population. We'll talk about that in a bit, too. But let's just start with this story that has garnered, I mean, I think my sense is it has garnered more media attention than it merits in some respects. And I think it's a function of, you know, it's being weaponized against Donald Trump. And I am all in favor of anything that can be weaponized against Donald Trump, frankly. But that's just the reality. I mean, I have a political agenda. I don't think people are terribly surprised to hear that I am very excited at the prospect of not necessarily of Joe Biden winning as much as I am Donald Trump losing. I think he represents a significant threat to the functioning of government. And that doesn't help my progressive agenda. But let's discuss it because, like I say, you know, when we were talking about this before we started to record the Afghan papers, which I almost feel like I have to explain. Because of how little attention they got. They were a set of documents from the Special Inspector General for the Afghanistan reconstruction. The Washington Post got a hold of them through, I think it was from a FOIA, actually. And they showed that essentially high-ranking officials in the military and in the civilian leadership were generally basically felt like the war was useless, that we couldn't win it, and that it was all just sort of, I want to say wankery, but, you know, we lost thousands of lives, civilian and our own military and I guess other military, and the public was never informed of it, that we just kept our presence there and went forward, you know, like almost like sunk costs and inertia. So with that said, though, these reports that the Russians were paying militants, some that were Taliban, some that appear to be sort of loosely affiliated, bounties for killing U.S. soldiers, you know, of which we're in the, you know, single and barely double digits over each year now of being killed. You know, apparently the White House knew about this. Now, every time, it seems like every day we get another report that they knew about it a month or two earlier than we were told initially. But tell us what your theory is behind why we didn't either hear about this earlier, or why Donald Trump doesn't just come out and say, like, look, you know, there are skirmishes between countries all the time that they don't all have to be inflamed into a major crisis. And that's why we didn't release that information. Like, what's your theory behind this?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me just say I agree with you. I think that, you know, this story, you know, that there may be less to it in terms of the substance than it's, you know, sort of being ginned up as a big, you know, super drama, simply because I think this stuff happens. And I think that there's been plenty of evidence that, you know, this may have been happening for a long period of time or off and on or different parties doing this. I mean, the Afghanistan is this, you know, kind of a, you know, a toxic swamp of all kinds of geopolitical activity, you know, forever, but particularly over the last couple of decades. So none of that, it didn't surprise me to hear that this was happening. But I think there are two facets to this that do make it interesting, neither of which are really being played up in the press, because it's being sort of, as you say, weaponized as sort of an act of, you know, of a lack of patriotism on the part of Donald Trump, and he put the troops at risk, et cetera, et cetera. And that may be useful. I mean, I agree with you. You know, if it works against him, more power to you. But for me, the two things that are interesting about this are the kind of leaks that have come out about it, which seem to be coming from all levels of the government. They seem to be coming from the Pentagon, coming from the intelligence community, coming maybe from the Department of Justice, maybe Treasury. There was a story about how they were tracing the bank accounts on this. All of that is pretty unusual. That level of leaking suggests to me that, you know, I don't know. Don't know if it's a conspiracy. I doubt that if it is, or to use Trump's word, collusion. But it does seem to me like this is the kind of thing now that, you know, Trump is looking weak. There's blood in the water. Maybe it's time some of these people are saying, look, we're going to stick the knife in and twist it. We're coming into the election. Maybe it's time to actually take some action against Donald Trump. That's one part of this. The other part is that I think, and I think this is really important, is that Donald Trump, you know, I have no doubt that he knew about this. You know, I'm sure he was briefed. He may not have paid any attention. It may, and as, you know, you and I have both sort of been saying, hey, you know, is it that big of a deal? And maybe he didn't think it was a big deal, whatever. But I think his motive here is really important, because I think what they really did not want to do, he didn't want to come out and say anything. He didn't want to do anything. He didn't want to pay any attention to it, which may have upset some of the intelligence and military people that he was being blasé about this whole thing, is because he wanted to readmit Vladimir Putin into the G7. And he had it in his head that he was going to have a big pageant here in the United States for the G7 this year. There was talk that he was going to invite Putin to come along, even though he wasn't technically part of it, and that he was going to add him to the G7 against the will of the rest of the G7. He was going to do it anyway.
Oh, my God. Just the most uncomfortable. He's just the most uncomfortable person to have, you know, throw a party.
Imagine it. I mean, it would have been an absolute nightmare. But, you know, at first he wanted to have it at his Doral Country Club. And, you know, remember last time they had a meeting, I think it was a NATO meeting, where he came and had a press conference at the end of it announcing that he was going to have it at Doral and gave a big infomercial about it. And we've got cabanas and we've got, you know, all this stuff. He gives this big thing. And there was some footage that was caught of, I think it was Trudeau and Boris Johnson of the UK and Macron, a couple of other people, all talking among themselves.
Oh, right.
Kind of, and they're all going, God, did you see him at the, did you see the look on his staff's face? Their jaws just dropped. I mean, laughing at him, basically. I mean, literally laughing at him. And so, you know, this whole thing, I think that's what was going on in Trump's view, that he was going to do this thing. Now, why he felt the need to reward Putin with this is, you know, you can imagine. Personally, I have no idea. Maybe Putin has something on him, or maybe it's just that he really wants Putin's help in getting reelected, which seems to be the main thing, the only thing Donald Trump has been thinking about for the last 3 years. Nothing else matters. So my feeling as I read this Russian bounty story has been that. It's just another illustration of Donald Trump's single-minded devotion to his own self-interest over anything else, and inability to even think about how, you know, gee, maybe this G7 thing isn't a great idea since we've got this bounty story out there, and, you know, that they're doing this thing, regardless of whether or not it was a huge deal. I can imagine how people in the military might have thought, wait a minute, dude, you know, come on, you know, we've got Putin putting bounties on our troops, and you're out here wanting to fade him at some big extravaganza right in the United States. Come on, you know. So they decided to drop a dime on him. So anyway, that's my theory. Take it or leave it. I don't know if it's
I think that's a very good theory, and I think that, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump right now, there is a, it seems to me that Donald Trump's primary objective at this point is he must get reelected. I mean, there are a lot of things that are coming into that are sort of converging right now, right? I mean, literally this week, you had Berman ousted at the Southern District of New York. It appears that he was that there was a couple of reasons why that seemed to be floating in the ether right now. One is that he refused essentially to unwind a conviction against Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, particularly a charge that implicated the president in terms of like the FEC things. Simultaneously, I don't know if you caught this week, that Omarosa was a former worker of Donald Trump's, both in the administration and in the private sector, was just buried with like 400 counts of NDA violations that just clearly are set up to intimidate and to bury her legal team. And I think there's a lot going on with Cohen and the fear of Donald Trump's fear that he is going to lose the election and he is going to be subject to criminal prosecution, that mm-hmm. he needs to basically wind down all of these investigations. You know, he can't make them. He can put in his own people and they can stop them. But that doesn't mean that they go away. There's a lot of career people in there. And what I think he needs to do is, for the most part, is to resolve all of these investigations so that they have ended before he leaves office. Now, I think in some instances he wants to pardon some people or realizes he's going to have to. I think he's trying to avoid that as much as possible because, you know, he can't pardon himself. And if he pardons these people, they could theoretically talk. And if he thinks he's going to lose the election, he could be in big trouble. And I think self-preservation is ongoing there. And so I would imagine that anything that involves anybody at this point is a function of him getting reelected and or protecting himself in the event that he doesn't get reelected, because he thinks, and I hope he is right, that he will be subject to a lot of criminal prosecution. And so they at the time that we were talking, they are starting to imply that the Justice Department may replace the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of New York. That's out of Brooklyn. And simultaneously, Jeffrey Epstein's confidant, Ghislaine Maxwell, was arrested this week. And that, you know, they've obviously been looking for her for an extended period of time. But there is a lot of reason to believe that, like, Bill Barr and Donald Trump have these odd connections to Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein. So there's a lot of things, like, that are stirring around that are, you know, because of the nature of how we're in the middle of a pandemic and an election and all these other things, I think what we're going to realize in a matter of weeks is a depression, if not a serious, severe recession. All these sort of side stories are getting a little bit lost. And, I mean, I'm going on vacation next week, and I just tell you, I find we're in a situation right now where it's all just seems so overwhelming to me. But all these things are building, and meanwhile, we as a nation have basically said we're going to pretend like this pandemic's not happening. It's such a bizarre time.
I've never seen anything like it. I don't think anybody has. I mean, it's a convergence of just a ton of different things happening all at once and all sort of interconnected. I mean, I think your point about Trump and the Department of Justice and, you know, whatever's going on in New York as well in the New York legal system. I mean, I think that has got to have Trump terrified. Because I don't know that he can resolve these things. I think you're absolutely right that they're working overtime to try and set it up so that they have those things at least somewhat in hand. I mean, you see them, you know, trying to do prior restraint on this book by his yep. niece, Mary Trump, and that actually was over. The lower court judge agreed to allow the restraint or this restraining order, whatever it was that they had, and then that was actually reversed by higher court. But you know that this information.
So wait, so that book will be coming out.
As it stands now, it will be coming out. But of course, they're undoubtedly going to appeal it to an even higher court in the state of New York, and we'll see. I mean, you know, this is you know, I don't know if they can keep that out. I mean, if there's one thing in U.S. law that seems pretty well established, it's that you know, you can't do things before the fact in this NDA business. Look, you know, an NDA is there are penalties for violating an NDA. They're financial. You don't get to go and, you know, gag somebody literally. You can't do that. I mean, this is just, you know, they I'm sure that whatever her NDA says, Mary Trump's NDA, and apparently one does exist of some sort, you know, there are financial penalties for violating it. That doesn't mean that you can stop it from coming out.
Right.
So this will be very interesting to see, especially since she's got this whole kind of psychological profile. She's a psychologist herself, and she's looking at this for the first time from the inside with a psychologist credential to go with it. So that, you know, I think people are really interested in this book going into the election, you know, talking about him. But regardless, all of this stuff, you know, I mean, one of the things that is in the Trump family, we saw that with the New York Times expose of, what was it, a couple years ago now, they committed fraud for decades, tax fraud for decades. I mean, the statute of limitations has run out. But, you know, this may be more recent. So, you know,
right.
We'll see what she has to say. But in any case, I think that is really what's driving him. And, you know, the sad part is that he has these enablers, Bill Barr in particular. You know, this guy, and this is just, I'll just throw this out here. You know, his big excuse for doing all the investigating of the investigators and all that stuff was that it's really wrong, really, really wrong for the Department of Justice to ever interfere in a political campaign. That was his entire thing. And he felt that the Department of Justice had overreached in investigating Trump for the Russia investigation in the first place, that they had gone way too far. Well, so what's happening now? Where is
right.
the Durham investigation? Where is it? When's that going to come out? What, October? I mean, is that going to be an October surprise? So, you know, we've got that whole thing kind of hovering out there and exposing Bill Barr, of course, for the hypocrite that he is. But nonetheless, I mean, this whole thing is just, like you say, a week away. I don't know. You know, I don't know what you'll come back to find.
And the thing is, you know, so many of these things are connected. I mean, the coronavirus, I think there was a lot of indication that the Republicans as a party and Donald Trump in particular, but the Republicans even in the Senate were in deep trouble. I think, you know, even in February, if you were starting to look at the numbers in the polling and whatnot, regardless, you know, without even knowing who the nominee was going to be. But if you looked around at the challengers at various Senate races, Republicans were in trouble. But now, I mean, the numbers are extraordinary. I mean, they are. We haven't seen this type of dynamic with a challenger. Now, you know, anything can change. It's quite possible by midweek next week, the alien invasion will have begun, and we don't know who the aliens will be supportive of, and we don't know if they'll change our form of government or whatever. I'm just trying to prognosticate in terms of 2020. So anything could happen between now and the election is my point. But in terms of how Donald Trump is reacting, I mean, I think this is the key issue is it's less, you know, anticipating what's going to happen and more understanding what are the pressures that are driving Donald Trump right now. And he's waking up every day. And I imagine he's, you know, refreshing every 10 minutes. These polls, which show, you know, a double digit lead for Joe Biden, they are attempting, and, you know, on the majority report every day, we like listen to what they're saying on Fox News, you know, what Laura Ingraham's saying, what Tucker Carlson is saying, what all the right wingers are saying to try and land a, you know, a glove on Joe Biden. And, you know, the things that you and I have criticized Joe Biden's candidacy for are, right now, at least, serving him well, which is that he doesn't really have any positions that are in any way aggressive that would, you know, stick out and give a toehold to Donald Trump and an opportunity for him to project Biden as being, you know, radical or anything like that. They try, but it just falls up flat on its face. The one thing that Biden, you know, I mean, that Trump has landed on is the sleepy Joe. And people are like, you know what? I'll take a sleepy Joe over you. And I mean, that's the problem is that there's, you know, I think I mentioned this last week that, you know, Dave Weigel was in the Tulsa crowd for that big rally, that big coming out. Oh, we should also mention Herman Cain, I think, was tweeting out that he was, you know, proud to be in Tulsa. And he was sort of. He has since been diagnosed with COVID-19 and is in, you know, my understanding is in the hospital. I mean, it's getting a serious case for him. And, but Dave Weigel had said, you know, one of the things he noticed at that rally was that all the T-shirts were either directed at the Democrats, but mostly still the Clintons. And, and to me that speaks volumes. And so, it speaks volumes, A, in their ability to sort of define Joe Biden. They can't even make, not only can they not define him, they can't even make fun of him. They can't figure out what the hook is. And it suggests to me that in addition to Hillary Clinton having some very generic liabilities as a candidate, one of her liabilities was the fact that she wasn't a man, a white man. And... You know, I mean, I think it's stating the obvious, but I mean, we can, you know, see it in very sort of clear relief in this situation. And so the point being that all of this is acting upon Donald Trump and his decisions are must all be filtered, seen as filtered through this, this reality that he's not going to get reelected or a concern that he won't. And I think it's going to make him increasingly desperate. And I think it's going to, you know, the idea that he's not, you know, doesn't want to mess up things with Russia or, you know, his perceived, I mean, you know, let's put it this way. If we have been told that by skeptics of the idea that Russia interfered, I guess, in our elections or that Donald Trump wasn't inviting them to do it, we've been told that it, this whole episode of Russiagate, as many people call it, has created a new posture for a new Cold War, as it were. And therefore, Donald Trump has had to been more antagonistic towards the Russians. I mean, this would have been a good opportunity for Donald Trump to sort of project like, I'm not in Russia's pocket.
Absolutely.
You know, and could have done something very, you know, even just symbolic, but for whatever reason didn't. And it's strange. It does, you know, you made the point that Trump has some other agenda involving Russia that does obviously involves third parties, right? In other words, like if this was just between him and Putin, he could have done this kabuki thing like Russia bad on you. We're going to, you know, but he needs to be able to sort of convince third parties and to bury this for the sake of third parties so that, that there's something else that's going on there in terms of that dynamic. And so, but all of this, you know, rolled in together, I think is creating an enormous amount of pressure and, I, you know, frankly, I'm concerned as to what comes next with this. You know, on one hand, I'm also terrified about what's happening with COVID in this country. There has been no response in to a large extent. Florida is starting to crack down now, but They have 10,000 new viruses as of Thursday of this week. And those were viruses contracted probably 10 to 14 days ago. And so the question is over the course of that 10 to 14 days, how many more people are catching it? And this is our situation. And, you know, people are talking about our kids going to go back to schools and this and that. We are day to day now. And Donald Trump is just, I think, seeing his opportunities slide down the drain.
Well, he's just in a complete case. It's total denial in terms of the pandemic with him now. I mean, he just said this week again, it's going away. We've got it under control. We're putting out little fires, and I think that's really at the heart of his most latest slide in the polls. He's been sliding, as you point out, and it's important to remember this. He was in trouble even before the coronavirus, the pandemic hit. And the Republicans knew that, but that just accelerated it as people watched him do those crazy things like those briefings where he was talking about, you know, maybe we could try bleach and the whole hydroxychloroquine weirdness. And I mean, he just showed over and over again that he was in way, way over his head, which most of us already knew, but this was a demonstration for the people in real time in a true crisis where people are dying and everybody was frightened to death, and it's not gotten any better. I mean, he literally cannot adjust to this thing. He cannot do it. It's impossible. So now, and I read that Jared Kushner. There's two camps in the White House. One is saying, you know, look, you got to change your course here on the virus. We've got to take charge and blah blah blah. And Kushner and his gang are saying, no, don't ignore it. Just carry on like it's not happening. And it feeds into Trump's belief somehow that this thing is going to go away. I mean, Trump has demonstrated clearly over the past few weeks that he has a real cognitive impairment in terms of understanding how this works. He doesn't get it. He says over and over again, and if we, you know, the more tests you do, the more cases you have. If we didn't test, we wouldn't have cases. That is illogical nonsense. It's complete, you know, it's less than a sixth grader's understanding of how the world works.
I mean,
it's crazy.
I don't know. I mean, I think on some level, I get what he's saying. It's just that, like, you're not supposed to say that out loud. You know, it's like the... I mean,
okay.
I mean,
hey, look, if they'd only keep my numbers down, I wouldn't be in such big trouble.
Well, that was the weird thing. I mean, he was saying this from the very beginning.
In the ocean or something.
Yeah, I mean, don't you remember when he said, like, I don't want the cruise liner to dock because then I'll have more cases. And for him, it's almost like he is, and maybe this is just a technique. I mean, I spoke to Jeff Charlotte, who wrote this piece about going to these rallies, and
that was good. Yeah, great.
Yeah, and like being a cult. And earlier this week, I also spoke to someone who's an expert on fascist lies. And I think on some level, what Donald Trump is doing is he's basically just sort of signaling, look, it's a numbers thing, you know. I mean, which is true. I mean, today I say, Florida has 10,000 new cases, and they set a new record. Now, I'm not in Florida. I don't feel it. Our producer Scott, he's in Florida, but if I was to ask him without anybody reporting a number, I'd be like, "How many cases are there?" And he'd just be like, "I don't know. I don't know if it's a new record or not." You know, and there is a certain logic to, like, if we don't, and certainly you remember this as well, probably as anybody, the Bush administration would say, you folks are in the reality-based community. We create reality, and you guys just report on it. And and to a certain extent, he's just out there and just, saying, like, full transparency, I'm just basically trying to keep numbers down by not recording them.
Right. What you don't know won't hurt me.
Yeah.
If you don't know how many people are dying, I will look better. But it doesn't, of course, change the fact that the people are dying.
Oh, absolutely. He doesn't care about that. He's just like, how bad does it look for me? And right. That's it.
I shouldn't laugh. I mean, I'm laughing mordantly, as they say, chuckling mordantly. But it's you know, this is the president. This is someone who, he's not just the president. He's the president running for re-election. And I think this is one of the things that I will never, ever, ever get over about him, is that the one thing he didn't understand is that, you know, presidents often sort of yearn for a crisis, because that's what makes great presidents, is how you come through a crisis, right? If you are truly an ambitious leader, what you want is to be able to prove your own greatness in some way, you know, leave a legacy. That's what they're always talking about. And so, you know, during placid, calm times, sometimes the president kind of feels like, man, I never got a chance to really show what I had, you know, really show what I could do. So the fact that Trump completely, you know, he's so ignorant, he doesn't understand any of that. But had he taken the opportunity to be a real leader in this, he probably could have won. He probably could have righted himself. There were enough people strong enough in his cult that, you know, and the Democrats were not putting up, you know, somebody who was, you know, going to, you know, really do something, that, you know, he probably could have pulled it off, because it was a chance for him to show real leadership, that businessman's, you know, I'm an executive, you're fired, you know, his whole myth, you know, it was BS, but nonetheless, and he couldn't do it. He just did not see that had he shown real leadership in this crisis, that people probably would have come around. Not everybody, but he could have gotten over the line. You know, he'll never, he's just too inept to understand what he had there. And instead he did the opposite. And now we're sitting here, you know, we're reaping the rewards, and he insists on kind of acting like it's not happening. This, you know, acting like it's in denial. And I really think that's what's killing him. And by the way, it's starting to take down Republicans with him. And God, I hope it does. I, you know, nothing will make me happier than to see the Republican Party slaughtered over their, you know, just unbelievable and inexplicable devotion to this man over the past 3 years. They watched him do, you know, the entire, everything he has done, the destruction that he's leaving in his wake would not have been possible without them. Would not have been possible.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
And they deserve to be taken down. And I, you know, I find it unforgivable. I will spend the rest of my life writing, you know, in my little way, reminding everybody what they did here, because they, you know, it's the most unforgivable thing they've ever done. And they've done a lot. So that's saying something.
I will also spend the rest of my life promoting that writing, because I agree with you totally. And anybody who thinks that Donald Trump is the problem with the Republican Party, as opposed to the product of the problem of the Republican Party, should look to those half dozen now QAnon congressional primary winners, beating establishment Republicans, ones that were supported by Donald Trump. You know, in some respects, you know, the inertia of the insanity of the Republican Party is may outpace Donald Trump by a little bit. Look, we didn't get a chance to talk about Oklahoma. 200,000 people plus are going to get expanded Medicaid. That is good news, everybody. The referendum won by just a hair, but enough so that literally hundreds of thousands of people are going to have health insurance that didn't have it before. Sadly, in Colorado, from my perspective, Andrew Romanoff lost to John Hickenlooper. Hickenlooper won fairly big. He is going to be someone that I would imagine we're going to be talking about. Hopefully not, but I suspect if Joe Biden wins and the Democrats take the Senate, we're going to be saying the name Hickenlooper far more times than we want to, and it's not going to be in a positive manner. That would be my guess. And also, sadly, in Kentucky, from my perspective, Charles Booker lost to Amy McGrath. I have a feeling we won't be saying Amy McGrath's name much more, and that is part of the problem. Charles Booker was an exciting candidate who was generating a lot of support. He came on a little bit late, didn't have the huge backing of the establishment Democrats that that McGrath had, but McGrath was a one-time loser on a congressional seat. Booker, of course, was as prominent in the Kentucky State House, and I think he has a future. I don't think that she does, despite the fact that she's the nominee against Mitch McConnell. But I hope I'm wrong. Let's put it that way. Digby, I'm headed on vacation. I will see you in a week. Thank you once again, as always. Very important for me to have an opportunity to talk to you each week to help me digest this this news, which can I can barely drive down my throat, frankly.
It's therapy for me, too. I need it, and I appreciate you having me. It's always informative. So anyway, have a great 4th. Enjoy your holiday, and I'll catch you when you get back.
Okay. Thank you, Digby. Supreme Court's made some significant rulings this week. Here to discuss those decisions, legal expert Scott Lemieux. So, Scott, we have more rulings this week. I'm not sure if we're going to have more. I think it's going to be the first time that we get some decisions from the Supreme Court in July in a long time. It's fairly rare that that happens. It's not completely unheard of. And, of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic, so all bets are off in many respects. This week, there were three, maybe arguably four, major rulings, one being, and we'll start with this one, June Medical, which was in many respects, and ultimately, I think, this was John Roberts' opinion, a do-over case, if you will, from a case that the Supreme Court heard, I guess, about 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. John Roberts this was not the case that John Roberts wanted, let's put it that way, to overturn a woman's right to choose. Tell us about June Medical.
So what was interesting about June Medical was that it concerned a Louisiana law that was essentially identical to a Texas law that the Supreme Court struck down in 2016 in the Whole Woman's Health case in Texas. And it really does seem like, and generally like pro-life litigators have been very clever about incrementally sort of undermining the right to choose. But in this case, I think they made a real mistake. And having said that, I partially don't blame them because Roberts dissented in Whole Woman's Health. And, you know, if you know anything about the Supreme Court, it's incredibly rare for a justice to go back on their own opinion, particularly within that low of a time frame. But it really does. So what happened is that, you know, the ruling came back. And of course, the four liberals just straightforwardly said, you know, apply Whole Woman's Health and struck it down. Roberts just filed a concurring opinion saying that the law should be struck down, but solely on stare decisis grounds. That is, and it just seems like, you know, he was sort of offended, you know. And I think a particular problem was that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals actually upheld the law, even though it's supposed to follow Supreme Court precedent. So, you know, it's fine for the Fifth Circuit to say, you know, we think Whole Woman's Health was wrong, but we're applying it. Whereas instead they came up with these just ridiculous reasons to pretend that the law was different. And I suspect that, you know, and Roberts, who after all has his name on the court, sort of showed that there were limits to the extent to which he can be pushed. Now,
okay. So wait, let me just stop you there for a moment so that we can get a little bit of background here.
Sure.
Whole Women's Health was what was known as a trap law, which is a targeted regulation against abortion of providers, which is a mechanism that anti-abortion activists, legal activists, have developed as a way of limiting in practice the ability of a woman to get an abortion. So in other words, you need to have 30-foot ceilings in your abortion clinic. And if you don't, then we're going to shut it down. So you still have a right to get an abortion. It's just that the abortion clinic could not, there's no abortion clinics. So sorry, because they couldn't do this. In this instance, it had to do with a relationship to admission privileges to a hospital, which no analogous outpatient services have with hospitals. It is completely medically unnecessary. It is just a cumbersome regulation to essentially effectively, not necessarily legally limit the rights, but to limit in practice the availability to exercise those rights that a woman has. And it was relevant because that first case that you mentioned, Whole Health, was from Texas. This one was from Louisiana, and the Fifth Circuit, they are the ones who have the Texas case as well. And so this was, in some respects, John Roberts is dealing with the insubordination. I mean, it really was like a very insubordinate thing for the Fifth Circuit to do by saying, like, we know you ruled on this a couple of years ago, but we're just going to go with the complete opposite. And John Roberts had to protect the institution of the court on some level.
Right. And that's, you're exactly right. What the Louisiana law did was require, doctors to have admission privileges at a hospital within 30 miles, even though fewer than one abortion a year results in a woman having to go to the hospital. And of course, a woman can go to the hospital whether or not the abortion doctor has admitting privileges. It makes literally no difference. Like, it's just almost farcically transparent attempt to just stop abortion clinics from remaining open or stopping doctors from being able to practice in them. And that's pretty obvious. And, Brett Kavanaugh and his dissent tried to sort of claim that, well, they didn't try hard enough. But that's exactly the problem, is that, a lot of pressure in these states can be put on hospitals to deny doctors the privilege. And so you can just eliminate the access to abortion this way. And again, the Supreme Court had settled that. And honestly, the Fifth Circuit would have been much better off saying, basically, we have no choice but to, uphold this for the time being. But we sort of invite the court to turn that down. This way, it was really just, ignoring binding precedent in ways that I think Roberts found offensive. Now, we should. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think where you're going next is to note that Roberts, while saying, look, I'm bound by precedent because it was only 3 or 4 years ago. People don't have that bad of a memory. He also basically said, however, if you really want to attack a woman's right to choose, here's how you do it.
Right. And so and what's interesting about this, and some of us conservative critics, and I sort of understand this, although I would come from the other direction, have pointed out that, it's sort of a weird way in which he says that, the precedent should be applied, but he also suggests that whole woman's health used the wrong standard. So that what Justice Kennedy said in Whole Woman's Health is that, on the one hand, you have to look at the burden placed on a woman. So under Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a restriction on abortion is unconstitutional if it imposes a quote-unquote undue burden on a woman's right to choose. And, in theory, that's a workable standard, but in practice, the Supreme Court has made it almost completely toothless. But another thing that Kennedy said is that you have to look at the burden, but you also have to look at the benefit. That if the state is claiming that this is for a woman's health, you actually have to look at, are there any health benefits? And the answer is obviously no. This does literally nothing to protect the health of women. It, if anything, it's bad because it would just force women onto the black market. And so what Roberts said is that, in his view, you can look at the burden imposed by a law, but you can't consider the benefits. Basically, you have to take the state at its word when it says that it's trying to protect a woman's health. And this is sort of, this is the third time Roberts has done this. We've seen this with the census case, and we talked about this as well with DACA, is that, on the one hand, in these opinions, Roberts sort of, just bends over backwards to say this obvious racism isn't racism, or this obvious, pretext is not a pretext. But he still then comes back and say, but you still did it wrong. So he's sort of saying that states should have more leeway, but basically, we ruled this specific procedure unconstitutional, so don't do that. I wouldn't be too optimistic about Roberts in the future. But having said that, it's still at least a partial victory. First of all, because it just keeps these clinics open for several years. So, it buys time. You never know what, there are two Republicans on the court who are pushing or over 70. Obviously, things are looking pretty good in both the presidential and Senate elections. And the second thing is that this is actually one of the most powerful tools that, if states can't have these admission privilege requirements and clinic restriction requirements, a lot of other kind of regulations that pro-lifers impose don't actually do as much. Waiting periods and stuff like that are bad policy, but they don't, have that big of an impact on abortion rates, that it's really taking away money or shutting down clinics are the two things that really, have a noticeable impact on abortion rates. So even if just these tools are taken away from the states, you know, that still matters. And I assume eventually, Republican legislators will come up with some other means of accomplishing that, and Roberts may go for that. But, you know, it still matters that we're making them do that. Plus, it does suggest that at a minimum, and I think this, I think, was more predictable, it certainly Roberts doesn't seem to be in any hurry to announce that Roe versus Wade is overruled, that, you know, certainly if it's going to be done, it's going to be done incrementally. Right. You know, he could have used this case to do that, and he didn't. Now, again, once is not an election year, you know, you never know going forward, but it certainly seems like Roberts sort of realizes, and again, I think a really big story between this and the Title VII case we talked about is that simply social conservatives are just getting crushed in the court of public opinion. That overruling Roe versus Wade, is opposed by 2-1 majorities. And if the public was even evenly split on the issue, I think Roberts would have acted very differently. So yes,
I want to stop you there, because I want to put a flag in that, and so that, you know, people understand just exactly, you know, what the mentality of. So Roberts is faced with what one could say would be sloppy lawyering. I mean, maybe not necessarily in the presentation of the case, although I think in this instance, coincidentally, it was. But
yeah.
The way that, and we've talked about this in the past, the way that these cases show up at the Supreme Court is not it's not random. There are entities out there. There are right wing entities and there are left wing entities. They're just not as well financed and not as cohesive entities that, you know, look for cases that they believe will provide the Supreme Court an opportunity to further a specific agenda. And it really feels like that. And these decisions are made, of course, 2 or 3 years in advance. I mean, it takes that long for these cases to get up there. And it really feels like the Federalist Society, which and affiliated entities that bring these cases and that sort of like plan these legal theories out, have been sort of out of sync on some level. And because, like you say, public opinion is has moved so quickly, I think, particularly during the Trump years, against these social conservatives, that the little bit of out of sync is even that much more problematic in terms of, you know, a guy like Roberts trying to fulfill this agenda.
Yeah, and in some ways, Roberts is sort of saving Republicans from themselves, whether deliberately or not, that, you know, as bad as this election year looks, you know, imagine Susan Collins trying to run in Maine if the Supreme Court had upheld that law or overruled Roe versus Wade. You know, it'd be,
To be fair to Susan Collins, apparently she didn't know that Brett Kavanaugh was anti-abortion.
Who could have known except for literally everything but his record? Yeah,
exactly.
Although, yeah, my view on Collins has always been that she's a liar, not an idiot. But, you know, hard to say at some level.
I will concur, but yeah. I will definitely concur. All right. So abortion rights, at least nominally, remain in place for another day. I mean, it's important to remind people there are multiple states across the country where effectively abortion has been outlawed. It's been, you know, abortion clinics have a tough time staying open. There are states where, you know, you need to drive 5-6 hours to get an abortion. But as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, the abortion case, a woman's right to choose an abortion is still stands. Let's talk about Espinoza, because this is a case out of Montana, and this is sort of I would describe this as Betsy DeVos's wet dream. Maybe that's an inappropriate way of discussing it, but I think that captures the sentiment.
Yeah. So what happened in this case is that Montana has a provision in its constitution that forbids taxpayer money from being used to fund religious organizations. So a lawsuit was brought under the idea so that Montana had a program that gave a tax credit, you know, made offer for a $150 tax credit for parents to use to attend private schools. And somebody sued Basically on the grounds that it would be, sort of testing whether it would be legal to use these tax credits to attend a parochial school. So the Montana Supreme Court knew about a 2017 case called Trinity Lutheran, where the Supreme Court said that, states could not deny public benefits to religious institutions if they otherwise qualified for them. So Montana, trying to get around that opinion, just struck down the program altogether. So it cannot be used for either secular or sectarian schools. So basically, it said, look, we're treating both schools the same. There's no discrimination because our Constitution forbids the funding of religious organizations. We're just, getting rid of the program altogether. So it was actually a very clever move on the part of the Montana Supreme Court, and yet it still wasn't enough. The Supreme Court, in a kind of amazing 5-4 decision, basically said once Montana offers the money, it can't take it away, even if, that basically religious organizations are being discriminated against, even though they're being treated the same as secular institutions. And although Roberts was kind of deliberately cagey about it, it seems like the court is saying that provision of the Montana Constitution is illegal. And a majority of states have either a constitutional or statutory prohibition on funding religious organizations. So this is just an incredibly radical assault on the separation of church and state. And it's one where I think that and there's a great Law Review article pointing this out, that that Breyer and Kagan kind of got played on this, that they actually joined the majority in Trinity Lutheran and basically tried to hope, apparently, to kind of narrow it. It's pretty safe to say that didn't take. I think Sotomayor was completely vindicated, and all four liberals dissented this time. And again, I think Ginsburg was very incredulous. Like, how could it be a violation of the Free Exercise Clause when religious and secular organizations are being treated exactly the same? But this really, basically creating a de facto requirement that taxpayers fund religious institutions or just don't try to solve social programs at all is really quite a remarkable and really radical holding.
Yeah, and this is something, like I say, at least in terms of schools, what Betsy DeVos has been wanting for a long time. But of course, this is a I don't know what you call it. Is it extortion? Is it blackmail on some level? If you're going to try and help folks, then you need to basically pay a VIG to religious organizations.
Right.
All right, let's move on to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This ruling was, I think, from the perspective of people who believe that this is an important agency, mixed, I guess.
Yeah, it could have been, basically my opinion about this is that on the one hand, I'm not persuaded. So basically what the case is about is that in an attempt to try to sort of insulate the CFPB, and again, Elizabeth Warren is a very smart person, and understood that a Republican administration has no interest in trying to protect consumers. And indeed, one of the things that brought off the end of the executive filibuster is that, Republicans for more than a year basically stopped anybody from being appointed. And ironically, they have Senator Elizabeth Warren and possibly Vice President Elizabeth Warren because they wouldn't let her be the head of the CFPB, which if she was, she would have been out fairly quickly. So they basically made it so that the terms, were longer than a presidential term and that somebody could only be fired for cause. So there was a lawsuit basically saying that, that people in agencies like that should serve at the pleasure of the president. And the Supreme Court 5-4 said yes. Now, I think on the merits, the dissenters are 100% right. There's just nothing in the Constitution that explicitly or implicitly prevents Congress from putting some checks on agencies it creates. We're not talking about an inherent part of the executive branch here like the cabinet. I have always believed that separation of powers should be flexible when you're talking about agencies created by Congress. Having said that, this isn't as egregious in its effects as some, it's not like the non-delegation doctrine we talked about last week. And the irony here is that what this opinion means is that Joe Biden can basically, put a real watchdog in there the second he takes office. So this isn't the kind of thing that only helps Republican presidents. It equally helps Democrats get rid of terrible Republican appointments. So, you know, it's not, you know, it's not as egregiously partisan as some of these things. Like, it seems to be just a legitimate, you know, dispute over how to read the Constitution. Now, some people like, you know, Josh Hawley, the alleged populist who has absolutely no populist views on any issue, was one of the attorneys general when he was attorney general of Missouri, who sued that, saying that because of the structure, the CFPB should be ruled unconstitutional altogether. And the court didn't do that. So that was always the danger of this lawsuit. But it was pretty clear from the oral argument that that was going to be a bridge too far, you know, and even really, you know, for the court. And so the CFPB stands. So really, in terms of its effects, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, I think the decision is wrong and kind of silly. But it also, it's not the kind of decision that stacks the deck in favor of Republican presidents any more than liberal ones. And fundamentally, you know, you could try to build in checks, but there's just no way of making Republicans run the executive branch well. The only solution is to get them out of office. You know, you can try, but fundamentally, you're just, you know, if Republicans are in charge of the executive branch, they're just not going to look out for marginalized interests, and that's just, you know, sort of the way it is. So, you know, it's I think mixed is fair. You know, I don't think it's right, but it's not nearly as damaging as some of the other separation of power arguments we're getting out of conservative courts.
All right, and lastly, let's just briefly touch on this. The House Judiciary Committee was seeking Mueller grand jury testimony, so that they could do, you know, a more complete investigation on just exactly what went on. And strike three, strike two, I don't know. Where would strike five? Where are we at with that?
Yeah, and basically the court pretty strongly signaled that it's just not going to hear the case, and certainly not issue a ruling before the election. So, and this has been really frustrating in that, you know, and this has sort of been clever on the part of conservatives of the court, is that they've basically undermined congressional oversight, but they've done it just by staying, you know, so basically Democrats always win at the lower courts on these issues because they clearly have, you know, the idea that Congress doesn't have the right to subpoena tax records is just ridiculous. You know, that's what oversight power is. But what's happened basically is that the Supreme Court just issues stays to these rulings and then just sits on them and does nothing. So basically, you know, the Supreme Court can stop these investigations from going forward, but without even issuing a ruling. So what's clever about this is that, you know, when, you know, if Biden wins, then all of a sudden, you know, the Republican court can discover that actually congressional oversight is fine. You know, we could get, you know, 30 estimate, you know, investigations about Joe Biden's email server or whatever it is they're going to, you know, look into. So they're not even issuing rulings that, you know, that they're not even owning it and saying basically the, you know, the president is king. And they're also opening themselves up to, again, rediscover limits on executive power, you know, should Trump lose, which I think they can, Supreme Court justices can read opinion polls just like anybody else can, and have to know that he's in pretty big trouble. So, you know, basically this is a position where the Supreme Court hasn't even said that Congress doesn't have the right to this testimony. They're just basically going to not force anybody to turn it over. And of course, needless to say, you know, Bill Barr, the, you know, the most the worst attorney general this country's ever had, is not going to do anything. And even from, you know, testimony we got earlier this week, you know, it's pretty obvious that, you know, both that Barr, by shutting down the investigation early, stopped a lot of things. And really, I think, you know, Robert Mueller does not look very good right now. You know, that, you know, basically he it was partly, you know, Mueller, you know, kind of being, you know, not saying enough that allowed Barr to lie about the initial, yep, you know, contents of the report, and to kind of spin it away. So, you know, I think, you know, and I can understand Mueller was in somewhat of a tough position given the nature of the Trump administration, but I think he really pulled up short, you know, in a lot of ways, too. So I would say that he doesn't look great. You know, that there was really no, you know, and he had to know that impeachment was not going to be a viable mechanism. So I think it was really on him to say that Trump obstructed justice, given how overwhelming the evidence was.
There's going to be a historical reckoning, I think, for that guy. You know, he may slide through the cracks, but he's not going to be looked in, you know, historically as somebody who was savvy about this. You know, who knows? You know, what accounted for that? All right. So lastly, What can we expect going forward? Are there going to be any more rulings next week and the weeks to come, or are we done? I mean, I thought I had anticipated there would be a couple of more, maybe faithless electors, one or two others. Are we going to hear those?
Yeah, I believe that there are still 8 outstanding cases. There's the case involving Trump's tax returns, which, again, I think we're just going to see an opinion that doesn't decide anything and just kicks it back to the lower courts. And there is that faithless elector case, which, we might talk when it comes down. I mean, fortunately, and it's just this, this galaxy brain scheme by Larry Lessig, who's kind of a well-meaning but naive law professor at Harvard. To basically, and again, I fully sympathize with his idea that we need to get rid of the Electoral College, and it's just a disaster. And it's really remarkable that basically nobody thinks Trump could win the popular vote, that literally the only question is whether he could just, have the Electoral College deliver him a fluke win if he loses by 5 points or something. And, but Lessig's remedy to getting to undermine the Electoral College is to make it illegal for states to force electors to vote along with their electorates. And it's just, again, it's just there's nothing in the Constitution that implies that. And that would just be incredibly dangerous, to just say that, that once you're an elector, you can vote for whoever you want. That would just be a disaster. But fortunately, it seems like, the Supreme Court, doesn't seem to be very sympathetic to that. And again, that's something that, we think now of the Electoral College benefiting Republicans. But really, it's not like it's only Republicans who could be faithless electors. And I think another thing we've forgotten is that, John Kerry was less than 200,000 votes in Ohio away from winning the Electoral College, even though he lost by the popular vote by a greater margin than Trump. And Obama also had a more favorable Electoral College map. So it's really unfortunate that Republicans have come to this idea that the Electoral College will always benefit them. Unlike the Senate, that's not actually true, but you'll never convince anybody because they happen to have won 2 elections in 20 years based on it. But I do think that it could be that, again, that's another case where, since this doesn't, since A, there's not really much of a constitutional basis, the lawsuit was brought by a liberal, and it doesn't necessarily help Republicans in any particular election. It looks like the Supreme Court's going to reject that. Again, never say never, but the oral argument, it didn't seem to be getting a very sympathetic hearing. But I think the last thing we need is for the Electoral College to be more unaccountable.
Right.
It's a terrible idea. But apparently, as far as we know, all these opinions will come down. As you say, I've never, it's very rare for a, to continue into July, but there was obviously the delay. And now we just have to hope that there are no resignations. That's the biggest thing. let's hope that we don't see Thomas or Alito handing Trump another seat.
From your mouth to God's ears, Scott LeMieux, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time, and hope to catch up with you when we hear more about these rulings.
Sounds good, Sam. Have a good staycation, and we will talk soon.
Thanks. Scott LeMieux is a professor of political science at the College of St. Rose and a blogger at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Last Halloween, our next guest was quickly summoned by his wife to check on a situation in their neighborhood that involves some young trick-or-treaters. The New York Police Department. Here to tell us what happened and how the NYPD is shielded from any kind of accountability, Eric Umansky from ProPublica. So, Eric, obviously, I thought your piece was great. You related your experience from a personal story on some level, or at least your involvement in it, into a issue that is ongoing, and that is really the accountability of the police. And this story for you started, I guess it was a year or so ago, last Halloween, maybe a little bit less. And you're in Brooklyn with your young child going out and Halloweening. And you described the situation in Brooklyn, which is Halloween and some of these Brooklyn neighborhoods is really amazing. That's everybody comes out and it's really crazy. All right, we'll take it from there. What did you see?
So, we live in Carroll Gardens, which is this very, picturesque, lots of brownstones, lots of stoops. And as you say, lots of kids out on Halloween. It is good getting in our neighborhood for candy. And it was actually my wife who was walking home with our then 6-year-old daughter. And they were walking down the main street in the neighborhood, which is called Court Street. It's a one-way street. And all of a sudden, she saw a few teenagers running and then an NYPD unmarked car, but with sirens on, zooming the wrong way down the one-way street. And this kid was trying to run away and jumped out into the street, and the NYPD car hit the kid. And the kid then basically went over the hood, fell off onto the ground. Another witness told me you could hear the crunch when, you know, a human body hits the ground, but popped up and ran away. And at that point, the cops actually turned their attention to another group of kids who were away from, didn't seem to have anything to do with these kids who were running away, were smaller, were younger. But the one thing that they did all have in common is that they were Black. And the police ended up lining a bunch of those kids up against the wall of our neighborhood movie theater and arresting those kids. And I then tracked what happened. My wife had called me. She had actually come home. Our daughter was upset, understandably, had come home with our daughter and told me to go back out. And so I went back out and saw the kids being arrested and taken away. And I followed what happened from there.
And to be clear, the second set of kids had nothing to do with the first set of kids, right?
Correct. I mean, not that we could
discern at that time.
Could see. Not that anybody could discern at the time. Yep.
And just to be clear, was at that time was the understanding of everybody around there that the kid who got hit by the car was running from the police, or was he just running across the street?
It was a very, you know, I wasn't there right at the moment. It was, I ended up speaking to a bunch of people, including obviously my wife, who was there. And, you know, it wasn't really clear what was going on. It all happened in, within a few seconds. It later turned out, and the police told me, that there had been a robbery in a nearby playground. A kid had, this is according to the police's account, been essentially jumped and had his cell phone stolen. He then flagged down a cop, and they went around the neighborhood, you know, where the kid who was in the police car then pointed out who he thought had done it. And that's how everything started. But really, and let me just explain a couple of other parts here. You know, I saw some other very troubling things. I obviously didn't know what happened, and I very much wanted to understand it and to hear the police's account. And a couple things happened. When I asked the police about it, they said that your wife didn't see what she thought she saw.
Well, just to be clear, yeah, that was ahead. You when you went out there and asked, yeah, you were asking the police essentially at that time or later?
No. What happened was, and sort of the actual chronological version is, I went out there. The kids, first of all, a couple of other troubling things happened. One, and this is stuff I saw, the kids had been put in a police van, and there had been five kids. They had lined up against the wall, all Black. Two of them they had let go, and who they seemed to let them go because they had actually family with them, because they were trick-or-treating with family. And then three kids they arrested. When they arrested those kids and put them in the van, one of the mothers who had been there tried to get the kids to share their parents' phone numbers so that she could call the parents to tell them they'd been arrested. And what happened at that point was an officer got in front of the window of the van to stop them from doing it. And another officer started yelling at her to shut up. And he was so in her face, I mean, literally, quite literally in her face, that I saw a commanding officer come up to him and kind of push him back. And then I went to the local precinct where the kids were taken. And neighbors had told the family, the police hadn't told the family that their kids were arrested, but neighbors had. And
how old are these kids?
12, 14, and 15. And I talked to the family. I waited with them for hours because these kids were held for about 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours. And parents weren't allowed to see them. They were handcuffed the whole time. And this is critical. They actually weren't charged with anything to do with this crime. And an officer did come out and said in not so many words, I mean, he did not apologize, but he said in not so many words that we understand we got the wrong kids and we're letting them go. We just need to, you know, essentially process that paperwork. And they eventually did let the kids go at about 1 a.m. and no paperwork, no record, no any records of what happened. They were just told, you can go home now.
I have one comment and a question at this point. One, I should say, I'm familiar with Court Street. And the idea that you have a cruiser, you know, particularly an unmarked one, right, where the where the siren is lower at that point, speeding down a one-way street in the opposite direction on Halloween is in any way justified in pursuit of an iPhone or whatever kind of phone it was is, I mean, the story could end right there and there would be a big problem, right? I mean, this is Halloween. There are people all over the place. And it seems to me that if you're going to be doing something like that, it better be for a good reason. There better be a greater threat than you're creating in that moment that you're trying to stop. That's just my own commentary. And I don't know if you ever, if that ever got addressed in your pursuit of things. But let me also just ask, too, while they were waiting to get released, were they themselves processed? In other words, were their names, were their fingerprints, were their photos, were they basically put into the system at that point?
So it's a good question. Police wouldn't answer that. The kids, I don't think that they were fingerprinted, but the sort of question of whether they are in the system or not, one of the mothers who I talked to, who amazingly enough is herself works for the NYPD, she works as a school safety officer, has been trying to find out an answer to that question for months and has been unable to do so. So let me address the comment that you were making before about going the wrong way and, you know, whether the risk of that exceeds any benefit of trying to do what they were trying to do. And the way that the police put it to me is in obtaining justice, because I think it's a valid question to ask. At the end of the day, what the police told me is something pretty amazing. They didn't say, look, this had been a violent crime and this was appropriate and we're sorry that there was an accident here. But again, we thought it was a dangerous, crime and we wanted to get at it. That's not what they said. What they said was, it didn't happen. Don't believe your own eyes. Don't believe the eyes of your wife or the other witnesses. The language that they used with me was an unidentified male ran over the hood of a stationary police vehicle. And that is the literal language, which is to say,
wow,
the police didn't hit the kid. The police didn't, you know, the car didn't hit the kid. The kid hit the car. And
the car was just, for whatever reason, parked in the middle of the street in the wrong direction.
Yeah, well, they acknowledged it went the wrong way down the street, but they said the car was stationary at the time he ran over the hood. And, you know, my wife was right there, and I ended up speaking to multiple other people who saw exactly what happened. And that, to me, you know, it's a very troubling thing that happened. But what I learned through the course of the reporting is there's a larger context here, which is that the police, when something is done wrong, when something is allegedly done wrong by the police, the system for holding them accountable and even disciplining officers is, frankly, inherently conflicted. because it is the NYPD policing itself, and there is legally civilian oversight, but that is not how it works in practice.
All right, well, let's go through that. Why don't you tell us what the theoretical mechanism in which to hold, and there's really two issues of accountability here, right? One is that they hit a kid with their vehicle. The other is that they rounded up three other kids for what appears to be very little reason. And in fact, also, you know, you're talking about 12 and 15 year old kids who are out with other kids with parents. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, I have a 14 year old daughter. I have done Halloween in this circumstance. I got to think that if there's one or two parents out with her friends, that the police are going to allow them to communicate with my daughter. That to me is striking. Yep. So tell us what the theoretical mechanism in which to hold them account is, and then what it actually works as.
Right. And then I can go through in practice. So there are theoretically in law, essentially two different avenues. One is, you know, the police have internal affairs, right? A unit devoted to investigating the police. And that's a real thing, and it happens. But in this case, the police, as I said, decided they didn't do anything wrong, right? There was nothing to investigate. And so that avenue was closed down, right? They just decided nothing there. So there's a second avenue, and I actually only really learned about it and understood it when I started calling around about this story, which is there's a thing called the civilian, it's actually called the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the CCRB, and it's exactly what it says. It's a board made up of primarily, although not exclusively, civilians. They still have some NYPD representatives on it, but who funded by the mayor, are not part of the police department, who investigate allegations of police abuse. And this board, the CCRB, gets a lot of them. They get about 7,000 complaints a year, about 3,000 involving physical force, you know, hurting civilians, right? And the CCRB, which has, you know, a couple hundred people working for it, they do real investigations, they can get files. They actually, in this instance, called my wife. My wife was very impressed by how thorough the investigator was. And at that point, they can recommend discipline. And if they find a case is substantiated and they decide to move it ahead, they can say that an officer should get X or Y discipline. But the reality is very simple. The NYPD has complete discretion throughout the process. So the commissioner can say, thank you very much for your suggestion of discipline. I am going to take that and put it here in my very special garbage can, and I appreciate it for your service, and move along. And it's not a theoretical thing. The NYPD ends up downgrading or dismissing recommendations from the Civilian Oversight Board about two-thirds of the time. And that is an undercount, because the NYPD can actually decide, we're not even going to let you make recommendations. We're actually going to take the case back before you make recommendations. And that is, again, even before that, the reality is the CCRB is often faced with all these constraints on its ability to investigate because the NYPD has to cooperate. So just to take one example, you know, body cam footage is obviously critical for these investigations. Well, these civilian investigators don't have direct access to it. They have to email the NYPD, ask for X or Y footage. The NYPD has discretion about sending what the footage that it thinks is relevant. It can redact footage, or it can just take its sweet time. So there are about 1,000 requests for body cam footage from investigators that have been sitting there for more than 3 months.
Wow. And,
you know, and let me just, sorry, let me get to one kind of upshot of all of this, which is, so you have about 3,000 complaints a year of physical use of force. What that ends up amounting to in terms of the discipline that actually happens. So I looked at 2018 because it's the year for which, most recent year for which there's complete data. 9 officers lost vacation days. That's the most severe thing.
They lose vacation days.
They lose vacation days, 9 officers. Yep.
How many days? Was it more than
The
two?
Worst one was, well, the worst one for a prohibited chokehold was 30 days, but that was a real kind of outlier. The least was 1 day.
So let me ask you this. The records of this body, they're not public either, right? I mean, are these ones that are subject to, I think it was Section 50 that prevented any type of disciplinary action or findings from being released in any way?
So this is something for which there is a sea change. As you mentioned, there was this law, 50A, in New York State that prohibited, made it literally illegal to release any disciplinary records of police, not just in New York City, but anywhere across the state. And that was repealed a couple of weeks ago. So for the first time, we are going to be able to see this information from the board. But, that's going to be a process. And yeah, up until now, that has been the case. I mean, even if you were the victim of police abuse and the CCRB investigated and found that your claims were merited, all they could tell you was that the claims were substantiated. They couldn't even tell you what discipline, if any, had happened.
Well, first off, the system that existed before 50A was repealed is nuts, right? I mean, it's basically like, it's almost, I mean, it really almost feels like we're giving you folks on this civilian complaint review board, you have a hobby. And the other aspect of that hobby is that you can't share it with anybody. Like I feel like my kid doing Legos is more productive at the end of the day than what they were doing, because there is absolutely no mechanism in which to act upon what they're doing, and including the almost like what I would call, I guess, an informal mechanism that at the very least exists now, and we don't know how it's going to function in practice. But theoretically, right, if the Civilian Complaint Review Board is doing this work in building a case, and you as a reporter have the ability to go and look at the case, there is some, I don't think it's sufficient, but there is at least some like mechanism for accountability, like public pressure, right?
Yep. And I think actually my guess is that that's going to happen. That's going to happen in some fashion, unless, by the way, one possibility is that the police unions, which have very much opposed the repeal of this law, could file a lawsuit and try to sort of throw some sand in it. But I think that barring that, we are going to be able to know names and know what's happening. And I think it's going to be very revelatory because, we should be clear, the most officers have had very few, if any, complaints against them and have certainly not had complaints substantiated against them. But what you do see, and you can quite literally see this in the chart, is that it's a little bit of a kind of U you know, most officers haven't had complaints against them. A few have had a few complaints against them. And then a bunch have had a lot of complaints against them.
This is sort of the 80-20 rule, right? 80% of the complaints come from 20% of the people.
Yeah, right. I mean, the stats are not quite that,
right.
But they are, but it is exactly that idea. And,
that dynamic.
And in fact, you have, if I'm remembering the number correctly, 753, again, this is as of 2018, officers active in the force, right? Those current police officers who had two or more complaints substantiated against them. And remember, it's very difficult for a case to be substantiated given all the impediments. And 200, about 200 plus, who had three or more complaints substantiated against them.
Wow.
And, you know, that's a thing.
How do you know that? How do you know that statistic? Only because they develop statistics that are not tied to a specific officer? Or, I mean, how do you find out?
The CCRB puts out these annual reports and has monthly reports where they tally all this stuff. And it's a weird combination of incredibly revelatory and incredibly useless,
right?
Because revelatory, because, well, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, holy shit, there are hundreds of officers on the force who've had repeated substantiated complaints against them. And of course, useless because, well, who are these officers? What do we do now? And you can't do anything, right? So now, again, with the repeal of 50A, that's going to change. But the issue I was highlighting is not, at least at the moment, which is the question of, well, what happens to those officers and who gets to decide? And right now, the answer to that is usually nothing, and it's the NYPD that decides.
Right. And the idea that, it remains to be seen, you know, how it works with this type of pressure, and if an officer, you know, has three incidences of confirmed, you know, confirmed complaints, and then all of a sudden the infrastructure that allows that officer to go out and have contact with people, there's theoretically a little bit more accountability, but we also don't know, you know, if that's going to work. It could be overwhelming. We don't know that there'll be the reporters to push this. We don't know that there'll be a public outcry. There is that becomes more of a public relations lever as opposed to any type of institutional lever, again, to hold them to account. There is it just sort of feels like the Civilian Complaint Review Board is the place where complaints go to die, right? I mean, it's like what they say about the Senate in terms of good ideas, that this is where they keep it. And then it's behind essentially a paywall and that is impenetrable. And this is where it goes to die. So getting back to your original story, was there any at the end of this, as you're sort of doggedly following this this story through, you know, all the means in which you could pursue it, where did it finally land? I mean, what answers did you get? Any answers? And people got to be aware, you're an investigative journalist. You're not, you know, right, just a parent who is worried about their kid or trying to find out. I mean, the idea that someone who works at the police department and cannot find out exactly whether their own child is in the system because of this is, it's even more disturbing, right? Who they're willing to sort of protect in what situations. But so you as an investigative journalist, could you find out what went on through this process?
The answer to that, the short answer to that is no. The reason why is, again, gets back to the NYPD's power throughout the process. So first of all, I, of course, asked the NYPD itself, asked them for information, not only about the case, but about this the discretion they have over the system and, you know, how it works. And I repeatedly asked them for their perspective, for their understanding of it. And I've quite literally not heard back, not since they gave me a statement back in November, you know, and I sent four different requests for comment over the past few weeks. So, you know, that's where it stands with them. There is this investigation by the CCRB into the incident, and it is not complete, and they can't tell me anything because it is not complete. And a couple of other things that suggest it could take a while. One is NYPD officers have not done any interviews with CCRB investigators since mid-March when the pandemic began. And that's because police unions, NYPD unions, decided that police shouldn't have to do any remote interviews. Police union representatives said, we don't do Zoom, right? They just decided they're not going to do that. And you've also had an enormous number of specific complaints and allegations about NYPD abuse during the protests. I think 170 different complaints. And meanwhile, the CCRB is facing a budget cut from the mayor. So you're going to be dealing with a big backlog. This case is open and 2,800 cases are open too. You know.
So lastly, Eric, is there, and this may be outside of your portfolio here, but is there anybody, is there a politician, is there an organization, is there a package of legislation somewhere which is attempting to address this specific aspect of it? I mean, I think obviously one of the big asks or demands, I should say, of protesters, and I think, frankly, a large portion of the American population, is to divert funds away from the police into other, services, essentially, to provide a lot of the work that the police do. But this process of accountability is really not implicated in it. I mean, hopefully there would be less of these, but it wouldn't necessarily be treated any differently. Does someone have, is there a concrete response to this problem? And is there a broader awareness of it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have actually, to be honest, asked that very question of politicians in New York, because you're right. Most of the proposals and most of the discussion have had to do with money and other aspects. And, this is, I would imagine that to truly address abuse by the police, you would need to have independent, truly empowered mechanisms for holding them accountable. And, that's certainly not how it works right now in New York City.
And do you know of anybody who's got any ideas? Is there if listeners want to take the next step and find out, like, okay, I'm aware of this problem, let me go support or amplify or the people who are working on it.
There have been a number of politicians who've been quite active in New York City regarding police reform generally. The honest answer is I don't know any who've advocated specifically on this issue. And actually, to tell you the truth, I've actually contacted politicians to ask them if they have specific proposals. And I wish this weren't the case, but I have yet to hear of any specific proposals.
Well, Eric, I think, indicates just how important your piece is. And so I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. And I hope people will follow it and read it and pass it around, because it's a very important perspective on one aspect, I think, of the problem of the police that is not really being directly addressed. I appreciate your time, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Eric Umansky is a deputy managing editor of ProPublica, where he has overseen two Pulitzer Prize-winning projects, most recently a series he edited on NYPD abuse of nuisance abatement laws that won the Pulitzer Gold Medal for Public Service. Umansky now oversees ProPublica's Trump administration coverage, including the Trump Inc. podcast with WNYC. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Folks, I'm going on vacation next week. Farron Cousins will be holding down the fort for me. Make sure you tune in for that. Also, want to wish everybody a happy 4th of July. Stay safe out there. We've got a big explosion of coronavirus around the country. Wear a mask, folks. It's not just for you. In fact, to a large extent, it's for the people next to you. And hopefully, they'll do the same. Want to also issue a special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers that converted into membership this week. When you do that, you make it possible for us to produce this show week in, week out. I cannot thank you enough. And if you're listening to the free one-hour podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm. We go live every day at noon. And then later is a podcast. Also, if you're looking for 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 8 minutes of headline news every morning from a left perspective, check out the AM Quickie. You can find it at amquickie.com. It's completely free. Every morning before 9 a.m., you will get the top headlines. Check it out, amquickie.com. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.